This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This week, two visionary speculative fiction writers. Ray Naylor joins us to talk about Where the Axe is Buried, a chilling and profound novel about mass surveillance, AI autocracy, and the fight for human freedom in a future not so far from our own. Then we speak with Tim Weed about The Afterlife Project, a novel that explores humanity's possible extinction and what may come after, through the eyes of a lone survivor 10,000 years in the future. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. In 2023, we spoke with Ray Naylor about his sci-fi novel, The Mountain and the Sea. That book explored highly developed non-human intelligence, both AI and a new species of superintelligent octopuses. In his new speculative fiction novel, Where the Axe is Buried, Naylor explores themes of power, control, and resistance. The story spans several autocratic states governed by AI prime ministers, exploring how surveillance, so-called rationalized decision-making, and stripped-down choice threaten human agency. Yet, amid bleak state systems, the novel clings to the enduring power of human dissatisfaction to challenge oppression. We spoke recently about this terrific book, so let's listen to that conversation now. Ray Naylor, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's really good to be here again.
So this book, Where the Axe is Buried, I found it such a thought-provoking book. It's about the spread of autocracy in the not-too-distant future and the overwhelming presence of mass surveillance. There are three different forms of states that are either autocratic and or surveilled. There's the Federation, the Union, and the Republic. What are these states? How are they different? And how are they similar?
So I wanted to kind of give the readers a bit of a balance or like a sort of compare and contrast between different forms of authoritarianism. I think there's, you know, there's the what we typically think of as authoritarianism, which is quite simply, you know, all of the power being amassed in the hands of a single person or of a group of people. But I think there's another way in which things can become authoritarian that has to do with just surveilling and collecting data on all of a society's members, and then also on reducing political choice in other ways. Like there are, you know, there's ways in which I think there's aspects of modern political life that are very authoritarian, even, let's say, in the European Union, right, where regulations take the place of discussion sometimes. And you have, instead of an open conversation about how to do things, you just have a technocratic decision made in the back rooms about how things will be done, right? So there's lots of ways in which we can have choice reduced. And for me, fundamentally, freedom is about having choice. And so it's a book about how to reduce people's choices and how people might work to try to get those choices back.
So autocracy crushes freedom. That's pretty clear, and crushes choice, but also mass surveillance. So address the panopticon that these societies are.
You know, especially in the age of COVID, I watched as Russia, for example, instituted this system of cameras all over Moscow and other cities where they were using them to make sure that people were complying with the quarantine schedules and other measures taken to reduce disease. And everybody, of course, predicted, and everybody was right, that the state would continue to use all of those surveillance methods after COVID had ceased. Now, there were other Western states that, you know, used surveillance during COVID and then backed off from those measures. So it's a mixed picture. But I think that the tendency has been to gather more and more data and try to use that data to make decisions that are not democratic decisions. They may not be negative decisions. They might be quite positive, but they're being made in a space of sort of solutions, right? And so one of the things that I try to explore in the book is what happens when you give up all of this ability to make decisions and instead you try to just plug in a system that comes up with solutions or supposed solutions to our problems.
Yeah, and this is now married in this novel, Where the Axe is Buried, to artificial intelligence. It plays a major role in the form of these AI PMs, prime ministers, that have been put in charge of various countries in order to, quote, rationalize the system. How does this work?
So this was a little bit based on you know, tendencies I'd seen in Western governments to be looking for ways to, and I actually heard the term used, rationalize, right? And reduce the political struggle between people and come up with some kind of technocratic solutions to how we might live. And I've heard in many places, it suggested that AI could help us do those kinds of things. I've had a lot of discussions with academics and other people who are even working on how AI can do things like help negotiate, things like that. I have enormous problems with this idea because artificial intelligence and these large language models, and I think artificial intelligence is a bit of a misnomer and a distraction, but these programs, these large language models that fundamentally just are algorithms that find the most next likely word in a certain context, are filled with bias. They're absolutely loaded with all of the biases of the internet. And they're not even the biases of humanity, because most of humanity still isn't really on the internet. Mm. Really, what we have is the biases of all of the digitized information that was available a few years ago on the internet to these machines scraping information. They're missing a lot of the context. They're missing, of course, any sort of lived experience, but what they're full of is a set of assumptions that aren't going to help us, in my opinion, move forward as a society, but we'll have a tendency just to cement things as they are and reduce the space for discussion about how we get beyond our differences.
Yeah, I mean, it's a growing problem when algorithms are, for example, responsible for evictions of people. But in this novel, you play back and forth with what looks like might be more rational ways of doing things. For example, cutting emissions, greenhouse gas emissions. So that I think the point is made that emissions have begun to come down for the first time since the industrial age. So one could see the notion that maybe tech will save us from ourselves.
It's extremely tempting, right, to think that all of our problems can be solved with technology, because the fact is, I think, that some of our problems can be solved with technology. And if you took away people's ability to debate about things and you tried to sort of push things through a series of logic gates, which is fundamentally what all computer programs are, you would come out probably with solutions like, well, we need to reduce emissions, so let's go ahead and do that. And we need to do X, Y, and Z to improve the environment. So let's go ahead and do those things because those are logical. So you would come up with some solutions that were really quite beneficial, right? And I think the temptation, because some of those solutions would be really beneficial, is to start using, you know, the PMs in this case, in the context of the novel, but this style of decision-making, which is not about debate or open discussion, because it is easier to get at, you know, solutions to some of our pressing problems. So I think it's a huge temptation. And I also wanted to present a bit of a more realistic picture, right? If you did this, if you turned over things to an authoritarian system, whether it's a person, whether it's a computer, certain things are going to become a lot easier to do. Authoritarian states can be highly nimble sometimes about what they're able to do in ways that democracies are not.
Right. There are two ideas at play here. It seems at first that in the novel that AI does a much better job than people at governing. And one of the characters is asked if this is better. And he says yes, because he can't think of any way to say no. But he feels like nothing is really changed. And I felt like this was also a point that's made in other ways in Where the Axe is Buried, Ray Naylor. The idea that revolutions can come and go, but systems have a way of perpetuating themselves. So address that both in the specific sense of the AI, but also in the larger sense, because you're really talking about how is power distributed, I think.
Yeah, there is this amazing persistence that systems have. Having lived in Russia and in Central Asia and the former republics of the Soviet Union, what you witnessed in Soviet history was the way in which the Soviet power, the Bolsheviks, and the leaders of the Soviet Union really were inheritors of the Tsar and the Tsar's regime in Russia, inheritors of its bureaucratic tendencies, but even inheritors in some ways of its speech patterns. So, for example, Stalin, who, you know, as many people know, was a seminarian when he was young and was training to be a priest, spoke and wrote in the style of the Orthodox Church, because that's where his education was. And so when Stalin was speaking to the people in this, you know, supposedly atheist system, he was speaking to them the way that a priest speaks to the congregation in an Orthodox church. So you can see this persistence of the system and persistence of ideas of who has power and how you speak, you know, and who is part of the flock and who, you know, has the ability to speak. So all of those systems really, really persist. And then the question becomes, how do you move power from one part of the system to another? How do you break a system finally and create something new? Mm-hmm. And I think it's not a question that the book answers, because I don't think fiction novels should try to answer questions, but I'm hoping that the book opens up this space in which that question can be explored.
Another question that you explore is the efficacy of protest, of revolutionary movements or political movements, because it seems that you proclaim on the one hand a pretty grim view. You talk about how, you know, in the world of this novel, it became clear that protest movements lost their ability to bring down autocracies. Why did they do that?
Unfortunately, I think this is just a reflection in many ways of the world that we're living in now and my feelings about that world. My feeling, having lived under many autocracies, so I've lived in Turkmenistan under an autocracy, in Tajikistan in Russia, in Azerbaijan, in Kazakhstan, and in Vietnam. Those are all autocratic states in one form or another. And one of the things I believe autocracies have learned is that in the past, they could be overthrown by mass protest. And what they've learned from one another is that if you want to maintain power, you don't give up power. No matter how many people you need to kill to suppress a protest, you do it. I think we saw this recently in Iran, when what would have probably overthrown the state 2 decades ago, a massive nationwide set of protests that went on for months and months, was simply ruthlessly suppressed by the state and completely failed to overturn autocracy. And again, I think we're seeing this around the world. They've learned the lesson, and the lesson is simply to be more brutal in their suppression of dissent than they were in the past, and not to have any qualms about what needs to be done to contain protest. So that's really just, unfortunately, somewhat like in The Mountain and the Sea, where, you know, the slave ships, the slave fishing vessels in the book are kind of something that's already happening, right? This is something that I think is pulled directly from our world. And how do we deal with that problem? I don't know. It needs to be protest plus some other elements, but what is the formula for overthrowing autocratic power? I think it remains to be seen.
And do you think that's true in the U.S.? Because some people, you know, Timothy Snyder has emigrated to Canada. You know, the guy who wrote on tyranny, along with two of his colleagues, they obviously think it's too late. But other people say that protests, mass protests, can do something in the early parts.
Well, I think in the United States, it's a combination of many things, where there's a system of checks and balances. There's protest. There is a certain unwillingness of the state to date to put down protests through huge amounts of violence. That's not to say that violence is not used, because it is. There is the economy and other elements. We see that, for example, you know, historically, dictatorships tend to occur when the economy is in a completely disastrous state, or when there's some other disaster that's overtaken the state, and we just don't see that here. So I don't see a lot of the same parallels, which is not to downplay anyone's concerns. Everyone should always be concerned about authoritarian tendencies in their government at all times, and be extremely vigilant and push back against them at all times, I think. And I think it's a work that has no end, right? But I think that a lot of the parallels that we're looking for in other states are false parallels, because what we're looking at every single time is in some way unprecedented, right? So I'm more in the camp of, I think we're going to get through whatever is going on here. And I think we've gotten through actually similar periods that we're not remembering well. There have been other extremely dangerous times in the United States, and we tend to downplay them. But I think that what's interesting about the way we look at history is this period of supposed political agreement, right? Or some kind of peace between the two parties, and some kind of mass agreement, is an extremely short period of time, kind of from the end of World War II up until maybe the early 1970s. And even within that time, it's just false, right? Like, there really isn't agreement. In the midst of that time, you have the Red Scare, you have the civil rights movement, you have all of these other things happening. I think we have a false idea about what American politics have been like. I think that American politics have largely been a politics of strife since the founding of the Republic, and that we are simply back in one of the escalated periods of strife.
But one big difference from those periods, and I completely agree with you. I mean, it's, you know, from the Civil War to the Palmer raids to, as you point out, the McCarthy era, and of course, the Jim Crow South, the overturning of Reconstruction. But the one big difference is that now we have a mass surveillance state. We have AI. We have these technological weapons that can be waged against us. And that's very pertinent to this novel, Where the Axe is Buried.
Yeah, I think that the ability of the state to gather information about people and use that information for good or for ill should be something that everyone is very, very concerned with. The whole invention of the surveillance state, you know, initially didn't include things like the ability to just gather this much data about people. And even in George Orwell's 1984, for example, the amount of data that the state is able to gather on people is primitive compared to the kind of data that we can now gather on people if we want to right now. I actually had, it was very interesting, I had a speaker who came and talked to a class of mine. And he walked into the classroom and basically introduced himself by going around to everyone in the class and commenting on their activities online, telling them, you know, it was so nice to see your family gathered at that picnic last weekend. Your daughters are so beautiful. You must be so proud. You know, I see that you used to work in X place. And he just basically had gone online, found all the very easy to find Google searchable information about people, and then just talked to them about it as if it was normal. And then he said, now you see, right, how disturbing it actually is how much information about you is so easily available. Like, it really makes you uncomfortable when someone actually talks to you about it and isn't just pretending it's not there, right?
That is chilling.
It was very chilling. It was really deeply disturbing. And it made you want to go and erase your entire online presence.
Well, it's why I almost never put anything personal online.
Yes, yes.
You know, this goes to the whole issue. I mean, we're on the brink of an AI supposed revolution, you know, where it's hard to think about whether these large language models are, you know, they act so sentient, but they're not, you know, just how dangerous they're going to be. You have a character in the novel, Ray Naylor, in Where the Axe is Buried, who says real evil is nothing more than a curious person inventing new monsters because they can, without a thought for the consequences. And it seemed to me that that's an apt description of people like Sam Altman and Elon Musk.
Yeah, I think there's an aspect of competitive capitalism that is deeply irresponsible. And I think one of the most, you know, disturbing things to me is how no one ever seems concerned about the ethical or moral concerns of things that are being not just invented, but then pushed into the market in all kinds of ways. And I think this has been the case with virtually all inventions that have been made. But AI is a particularly dangerous one. One of the reasons it's dangerous is because people are totally befuddled about what it is, right? Another reason it's dangerous is because people are very distracted by this idea of consciousness or sentience. And the questions they're not asking themselves in enough detail are, how is this going to change the marketplace, damage people's work, damage quality of life, affect political decision-making, et cetera, et cetera. And so one of the great dangers for me of artificial intelligence is this name, artificial intelligence, and the way that it has manipulated discourse so that people are not properly paying attention to the concrete impacts that this technology, which is just very sophisticated computer programs, largely using language like math, right, with huge computational power and a really complex series of, you know, logic gates and other great ways to, you know, make it look as if thinking is happening in many ways. The questions they're not asking themselves are the most dangerous ones. What happens to employment? What happens to job security? What happens to information, right? What happens to our sense of history? What happens when, instead of going to a website, you're asking a question and you're getting an aggregate response, right? From many sources, many of which could not be verified or are not properly verified. A really good example is I saw that someone had posted on X, they had asked Grok, the X version of AI, what are the 20 red flags about the National Endowment for Democracy? And Grok gave them 20 red flags about the National Endowment for Democracy. Now, I've worked on disinformation quite a bit, and many of those were drawn from Russian disinformation websites and news reports whose object was to weaken and damage our work overseas.
I don't know what this foundation of...
So the National Endowment of Democracy works on lots of things, but one of the things it does is try to encourage and strengthen democracies overseas. So it was, you know, things like it would say, the National Endowment of Democracy seeks to, you know, alter societies abroad and make sure that only liberal governments are elected, right? It's basically all of these falsehoods that have been put into the noosphere, right? The information sphere that we live in by Russian disinformation. And these were being picked up by AI and then put out as if they were true. With no one really knowing what the source is, they seem perfectly reasonable. They seem logical, but their source is actually a lie that's been put into the atmosphere a long time ago and has been floating around for a while. And Grok is innocent. It just picks these things up, right? I mean, it can be used in many ways that are not innocent, as I think we've seen more recently. But It just picks these things up and it has no way of distinguishing between truth and falsehood. Then it gives it to you. And because people have a tendency to believe what they're told on a screen, and especially things that are written down, they take that as evidence.
Garbage in, garbage out.
Exactly.
But with all this, the underlying plot of this novel is centered around a rebellion against the systems of control. So without giving anything away, address that, because one could think that this was hopeless, but maybe it's not.
I think one of the things that's continually underestimated is the human capacity to want to remain free, to make choices for oneself. I think that we have this extraordinary dissatisfaction that is built into all life on the planet and definitely built into human beings. And it's deeply rooted in biology and it's inseparable from what it is to be alive. And it's one of those things that makes things like utopias ridiculous, right? There's no solution to dissatisfaction, because if there was, we would have died out a long time ago. And I'll give you an example. I imagine a world where you are hungry. So you go looking in the savannah, you're in, you know, you're a primitive human looking in the savannah for food. You find a tree full of apples or some other fruit. You eat from that tree. You're satisfied. What's the result of that? If the satisfaction is permanent, you die, right? There has to be a limit to satisfaction. There has to be a point at which you return to being hungry and dissatisfied. There has to be this search for the next thing, because if there's not, life can't function. So I think that dissatisfaction with things as they are is the engine that will always eventually undermine autocracy. It grinds away at autocracy from the inside. It's impossible to contain forever. It brings down systems. It erodes all power and moves it in different and unexpected ways. And it's the thing I probably have the most faith in. It's just simply people's inability to agree for any period of time about how things should be structured.
So how do you reconcile that with what you said before, that these autocracies have just learned that they can hold on to power by holding on to power ruthlessly?
Yeah, I think that the stakes are much higher than they've ever been before. The struggle is much greater than it's ever been before. It's much more difficult. One of the things that the availability of information has done is allow governments to share information and allow autocrats to share information and technologies for oppression. But it's also allowed, you know, dissident movements to share information and technologies for evasion. And it's a war in some degree, right? And I think that, yeah, the revolutionaries and the people of today who are seeking change have a much more difficult and are going to have a much more difficult time of it than people in the past. But I do think that because that discontent and that push toward wanting something different is eternal, eventually it overturns systems, even when those systems are thickly cemented into place.
Well, you know, I see that. I guess I see an other vulnerability of the systems of autocracy, and that is that they are inevitably chaotic. They inevitably do a bad job. I mean, Trump is the best example of that right now, but they just do not create societies that work ultimately. And we are so much on the edge of environmental and economic and, you know, all the other ways of collapse, of the collapse of biodiversity of our world, that it is hard to see how these things can continue.
Yeah, autocratic systems do a terrible job. That is absolutely true. And I think if you wanted a great example of that, it is the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. They just did a terrible job of trying to manage their economy. They did a terrible job of a lot of things. But one sort of more positive example of how democracy works and why I think it is superior, I think, is landing on the moon. The Soviets were ahead of us for many years in rocket science and in all the math that had to do with space exploration. And they got to the moon first with unmanned modules, and they did all sorts of really amazing things. but they just fundamentally were unable to solve the problem of landing human beings on the moon and then getting them off the moon safely and returning them to Earth. And I think that the fundamental reason why they could not do this is that in order to do that, you need to have about 40,000 arguments that occur heatedly between highly educated people in total safety. And what I mean by that is in a system that allows for argument to happen without lethal consequences. And the Soviet system was never that system. Many of the rocket designers were designing rockets from gulags. This is real history, right? And other ones were put into gulags for having disagreements with other rocket scientists. Whereas on the American side, and had very little in many ways to do with the government per se, it was cultural. You had this ability for all of these people to sit in rooms and duke it out intellectually and solve all 40,000 of those problems to the degree that we did something absolutely amazing. Not putting people on the moon, that's amazing. Getting them home, right? From the moon. That is an incredible feat. The most amazing thing that happened with the whole moon shot was when those people landed in the water alive on Earth, having visited the moon. And you can only do that in an open society filled with argument, in which people are allowed to disagree and yell at each other and get mad and push their points across, maybe in ways that are unfair, and do all those ugly things, but do it in a system that is safe and that encourages that kind of behavior and that allows for it.
Well, that is a wonderful point, because I would have said the reason that they failed, but I think this one is just as important, is corruption. That when you have corruption, you just simply cannot have a functioning society.
But it's absolutely also true. And one of the features of the Soviet Union that doesn't get talked about enough is the totalized corruption within the system, right? And that's also a result of autocracies. Autocracies are completely corrupt, and corrupt states are totally ineffective and unable to carry out anything effectively. Just look at the war that Russia is fighting in Ukraine. Their army is garbage, their tactics are garbage, and that's all a result of massive corruption.
Well, we didn't talk a whole lot about the plot, and that was partly on purpose because this is absolutely a page turner. But you can't really say a whole lot about the plot without giving everything away. But I just want to tell my listeners, you've got to read Where the Axe is Buried. And Ray Naylor, it is absolutely fantastic to talk with you.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to talk to you too. Thanks for having me on again.
Ray Naylor. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our previous conversation with Naylor about his novel, The Mountain and the Sea. Next up, we go 10,000 years into the future. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Novelist Tim Weed's The Afterlife Project envisions a post-human future sparked by a climate crisis and geoengineering gone wrong. After a hyper-pandemic leads to human infertility, one man awakens from suspended animation 10,000 years in the future. Through rich descriptions of ecological recovery, philosophical reflections, and a new religion, the novel explores what remains and evolves after catastrophe. Tim Weed, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
This speculative fiction novel, The Afterlife Project, is centered around a search for indications that the human race has not died out after what you call a hyper pandemic. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, I was sort of casting around for a new novel project, and I've written a couple novels, already, and I was looking for a new one, and I wanted it to be about things that were big. I wanted it to be about geologic time, mass extinction, you know, the fate of the human species, you know, big, big things. And I didn't know if I could do it, but I was in, I had a job with National Geographic as a traveling lecturer on this trip in Tierra del Fuego. And I was on a small ship, an expeditionary ship with about 150 other people. But on that ship were some very interesting scientists, including an astrophysicist who was the head of the Mauna Loa Observatory. And the other sort of notable scientist was a young paleoclimatologist from Princeton. And so we had these interesting conversations. I was starting to get some ideas, and I asked the astrophysicist, well, what would you think? I mean, given existing technology, do you think it's possible that we could maybe send someone 10,000 years into the future? And he took out an envelope and started writing on it, doing calculations. He said, yeah, well, actually, yeah, if you use quantum physics and you know, doing all these complex calculations, you could do that. And so I was like, okay, great. That gives me permission to do what I kind of want to do with this book. And then the paleoclimatologist gave me, I said, well, what do you think about what would the climate be like in 10,000 years? And he said, well, you know, we can look at the past and sort of learn from that. And so I was very inspired by those conversations, and it sort of set me off on this novel. I'm also inspired by some local places, you know, places where I spend a lot of time up on a sort of overlooking the Green Mountains, and this idea of a person stranded in the deep future looking out at this wilderness kind of caught my attention, novelistic attention, and that's sort of where the novel started.
This speculative fiction novel, The Afterlife Project, is centered around a search for indications that the human race has not died out after what you call a hyper-pandemic. What inspired you to write this book?
So part of what I was interested in looking at was sort of extrapolating worst-case scenarios in terms of what could happen given the difficulties we're having environmentally, you know, with the climate catastrophe and habitat loss and you know, the possibility of mass extinction. And so I sort of fast-forwarded that a little bit and brought us to 2068, where you had some climate-related disasters, a whole chain of disasters that had occurred. And the worst of this, the worst sort of thing for humanity coming out of this chain of disasters was a microbe that became sort of a hyperpandemic and infected pretty much everybody or almost everybody on the planet and resulted in the loss of fertility so that the human species looked very much like it was in great danger of extinction. So that was sort of the starting point. That's a situation where the characters find themselves and the difficulty that they find themselves in.
It comes about because of, well, I mean, obviously there are other factors, but it comes about as a response, a geoengineering response to the climate catastrophe, the Pinatubo solution. And this is actually the kind of solution that is being seriously considered by geoengineering people. So talk about that Pinatubo solution and then, you know, weigh in on what you think about geoengineering.
Yeah. So in the book, the Pinatubo solution is based on the, you know, the truth that when the Pinatubo erupted, I can't remember exactly what year that was, but it caused several years of cooler weather. The particulate matter in the atmosphere caused this cooler weather, reflected back some of the rays of the sun and led to 2 years of, at the time, misery. But the idea was that finally the human species, after, you know, decades, as we've already seen, but even further decades of kind of ignoring the problem of climate change and everything else, finally decides that it's reached the point, things have gotten to such a point of crisis because food chains are collapsing and, you know, other, you know, agriculture in the world is in trouble and all of these things that are predicted to happen. So they come up with this solution to geoengineer using a bunch of forced volcanic eruptions to, you know, fill the atmosphere with particulate matter and sort of create the conditions, give themselves time basically by ejecting all this particulate matter into the atmosphere to serve as kind of an umbrella from climate change, or at least slow it down to give them time to work on another solution. And of course, it gets out of control. You know, this is what causes that microbe to sort of be unearthed from the permafrost up north, and it just causes all kinds of terrible chain reactions. So it does seem to work for a while, but in the end, it makes things worse. What do I think about geoengineering? I think, I mean, personally, not in the context of this novel, but personally, I think it's worth exploring. I think we have to explore everything. But I also think that we have to be very cautious, and we have to keep in mind that that technology and our grasp of technology can lead us to hubris, to doing things without thinking and without even knowing what the unintended consequences can be. So I'm all for exploring geoengineering solutions, but I think we should do it with a great deal of caution as well.
And that also goes to questions about the geopolitical context, or let's say the social context, because of course, geoengineering solutions take place within a certain socioeconomic structure. I mean, they're likely to be pushed by big corporations. So what kind of thinking did you do about those influences?
So it was a moment in the novel, and sort of this is still all the backstory of the novel, because all of this happened before the novel begins. But in the backstory of the novel, it's a hopeful time. It's sort of like, okay, well, finally, international governments are cooperating. They're sort of harnessing their corporations and their sort of scientists, and everybody's working together out of desperation to make this happen. So there's a moment of hope. But then when things start to go badly, then the world situation rapidly deteriorates, as you would expect. Governments are overthrown. Chaos erupts in many parts of the world. The economy completely crashes. The financial system crashes. So all of that is over a period of fairly rapid period of time kind of disintegrates and leaving the world in a state of chaos. And also the idea that the psychological realization that the human species may be coming to an end has huge ramifications for that society as well, and creates a whole sense of nihilism and you know, there's no future, so why do we care? That kind of thing.
And now let's go to 10,000 150 years into the future. First of all, talk about this time dilation machine or module. I don't have a mind for physics.
I don't either, honestly. So this was the part that the astrophysicist from Mauna Loa, from the University of Hawaii, really gave me permission to write it, in a sense, because in a way I'm taking his word for it, that yes, something like this could work. It's the kind of thing we would need if we were going to try to do interstellar travel, for example, if we wanted to try to colonize one of these exoplanets on Proxima Centauri or you know, one of these, the close, so-called close stars, because those stars, Proxima Centauri, would take us 10,000 years to reach, which is amazing. You know, if we're traveling the speed of light, that's amazing. We're just under the speed of light. But you can imagine that you can't send a live colonist 10,000 years into the future. It would have to be a huge ship that would be able to support, you know, hundreds of generations of humans. And that's not within our reach. And so in the story, as things start to fall apart in the world, that dream of interstellar travel or colonizing an exoplanet in the distant star falls by the wayside pretty quickly. It's just not possible. But they're left with this technology, the time dilation sphere, which they had developed. A team called the Centauri Project had developed. And so they put it in a geologically stable area inside a cave and send a test subject 10,000 years in the future. The way that it works is, and this is, again, where, you know, I'm taking this from my friend, the astrophysicist. I'm taking his word for it. I don't know a lot about, my daughter was a physics major, but I'm not. So it's a two spheres, kind of one sphere cupped inside another sphere. And in between the two spheres is a quantum computer. And what the quantum computer does is convince the inner sphere that the person inside the inner sphere is traveling at or near the speed of light. And when you travel near the speed of light, as you know from movies like Interstellar, your sense of time is different from the sense of time outside the sphere. It changes. It changes the passage of time. There's coordinate time and subjective time. So inside the sphere, this person who's traveling at around the speed of light, time is moving much more slowly for him than for the world outside the sphere. So inside the sphere, not a lot of time passes. He still has to go into a state of medical suspended animation in order to survive it, but it's not 10,000 years inside the sphere. It's only about 30 years. And then when the fusion reactor that powers the sphere kind of runs itself out, he finds himself alone in this cave, the same cave, and he comes out in the world, it's 10,000 years later.
So tell us about him. Tell us about Nick and also the love of his life, this brilliant scientist, Natalie.
Natalie, yeah. So Nick is a microbiologist, and his career has been spent studying the microbes of what we might call analog environments, sort of extremophiles, bacteria that live in places where not a lot of sun can reach, and so that they have other ways of living besides photosynthesis. And as a result of this, he spent a lot of his career in volcanic areas and developed a kind of immunity to the microbe that caused the hyperpandemic. And so he was chosen as a test subject. He was part of the Centauri team, and he was chosen as a test subject. And, you know, he's a solitary guy, and he's got some skills of survival. But what he faces in the deep future is this extreme sense of loneliness, because when he gets there, there are no other humans around. And then Natalie, who is they're a couple, and she is one of the brilliant minds of her generation. She's a physicist herself, and she was the one who developed the time dilation sphere, and is also just kind of an adventurous type. She's based a little bit on my grandmother, who was a real powerhouse of a person, and so she's someone that I love her as a character, but her entire being is her mission in life. Is to save the human race. That's really what sort of every decision that she makes is sort of based around this idea that that's what she's dedicated her life to.
Now, Nick wakes up in the world 10,000 years into the deep future. The novel, The Afterlife Project, expresses the idea that the planet will survive, but the real question is whether human beings will. Talk about where the planet is. You know, there has been a mass extinction, and yeah. Is 10,000 years even enough for the planet to recover? Talk about where the planet is at that point and yeah. What kind of science underpins how you treated that.
Yeah, so there's a history, a geological history of Earth is something that I was really lucky enough to spend a lot of time studying for this book, and it's an amazing story. I mean, there's a couple of things to say about it. One is, our conception of time is so warped. There's a geologist named Marcia Bjornerud who wrote a book called Timefulness. And in that book, she says that the average human being living today has about the same conception of time that the average human being living in the Middle Ages had of geography. And if you look at the maps of the Middle Ages, that's what we're looking at. It's very hard to understand what 4.5 billion years means. But in that 4.5 billion years, there have been five mass extinctions, and the mass extinctions have been, you know, very, we have ranged in severity, but some of them have been very severe. And so studying this is very interesting because it gives you perspective. The sort of bottom line message that comes out of this for me is that, yeah, life on planet Earth is going to find a way. It always does. So I'm not worried about life on planet Earth so much. It's more, will the human species survive? Will a lot of the species that we share the planet with right now survive? We are at the beginning of a sixth major or a sixth mass extinction, but the indications are, and this is where we're sort of talking to my paleoclimatologist friends and reading a lot of stuff, was kind of made me feel a bit more optimistic about the future of nature, at least. The one that we're facing is much less severe than any of the other five. It looks like it's going to be much less severe than any of the other five mass extinctions that have occurred so far. Even in the worst case scenario, if we use all of the carbon that's stored in the ground, you know, all of the fossil fuels that are available to us. Even if we use all that, it'll still be less severe. That doesn't mean it won't be severe, and it doesn't mean that we're not in very grave danger as a species. And it doesn't mean that a lot of the species that we know and love and are familiar with will go extinct. But so in my book, it sort of posits the fossil fuel, the sort of carbon that's being burned, and you know, the greenhouse gases that are being burned now, we'll cycle out eventually. We'll reach in a couple hundred years, just a couple hundred years, we'll reach the peak of the climate disaster in terms of the warming that's going to occur. And then over the next about 100,000 years or so, as I understand it, those sort of greenhouse gases will cycle out of the system. And so it'll be a really bad, very quick surge to high temperatures. And then gradually over the next 100 or 100,000 years or more, it will cycle out and things will return to pre-industrial norms. 100,000 years is a long time. On the scale of Earth history, it is not a long time. And 10,000 years also feels like a long time to us, and it feels like a long time to the characters in the novel, but it's really not a long time in geological history. But the situation in the novel is that it's sort of the recovery has begun, and the ecosystems have already started to evolve and are actually pretty rich and pretty amazing. Nick wakes up to find himself in an old growth forest, which he has never seen before. None of us have really ever seen an old growth forest. So that's the situation that in the novel.
You know, I should say that I've spoken with the climate scientist Michael Mann on a number of occasions, and he actually says that the recovery could be far more rapid within a few decades. Yeah. If we stopped burning fossil fuels right now, because even, he says, sea level rise will continue.
Yes.
But that the oceans will be able to absorb enough carbon to begin dropping the carbon in the atmosphere within like 30 years.
Yeah, that would be great. If that is presuming that we're able to get a handle, I think, on our emissions.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's pretty amazing to study. The other thing is, I mean, looking back to those mass extinctions, the five previous mass extinctions were all caused in one way or another by greenhouse gases of a similar type. The concentrations were much higher than we're going to be facing. The difference with our situation is that the changes are happening so much more quickly. And so that the ability of species and ecosystems to adapt is really in question, because it's just happening so quickly. So it really, it's very much an emergency that we have to kind of stop the emissions and reverse what we're doing.
Right. Now, there was something in the book that really interested me, but you didn't really develop it. You have hints about a more advanced intelligence in the non-human animals that survive. Talk about that and why you just hinted at that. Why didn't you develop that idea more?
Well, that's interesting because, well, two things about that. One is that idea sort of came, I don't know, you know, you never know when you're writing a novel where these ideas come from, but I can pin it down partly to an essay by Loren Isley, who's a great geologist and naturalist. And he wrote an essay called The Fire Apes. And the essay ends with him watching his bird feeder and watching a squirrel. And a squirrel climbs up on the bird feeder and sort of stops and looks at him. And he has this revelation about the fact that, well, if humanity disappears, there's a track of the most sentient species on the planet, and some other species will take that over. So that's sort of that idea, is that, you know, if humanity is going to be extinct, then some other creature will sort of take the sentient track and become the maybe the dominant sentient animal on the planet. And you know, it's also just sort of in my observations, I think that non-human animals have a lot more sentience than we give them credit for, than we tend to. So it's kind of playing around with that idea. Why I didn't really develop it is, well, partly honestly, because I'm considering working on a sequel in which that'll be a major aspect of the story.
I was really hoping you would say that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I have to write it, but I have some ideas.
Right. And, you know, my bet is on possums or raccoons.
Yeah, they're pretty smart.
On the other hand, you have these cat companions, and I could totally relate to intelligent cats.
Yeah. Cats, you know, Felis silvestris, the domestic house cat, ends up surviving in my story and kind of fading back into the wilderness. But as soon as they run into a human being, they go back to their evolutionary path and they adopt this human being and say, hey, we'll be your pets, but you've got to feed us. And so it is, you know, he has to have some companions because he lives in a very lonely existence. And I happen to have cats. I have three cats, two of which are adoptees that my daughter, who lived in Chicago and now lives in Germany, sort of gave to us. But so I live among a little mini pride of cats, and I love watching them. And it was fun to bring that into the story.
And we are talking with Tim Weed about his speculative fiction novel, The Afterlife Project. You know, I wanted to ask you about that title. What do you mean by afterlife?
Yeah, so I was a little worried that the title would be deceptive because it's not so much. Well, actually, it is playing around with the idea of the afterlife for individual human beings, but really it's more of a reference to an afterlife for humanity. After humanity basically either goes extinct or very much is on the edge of extinction, is there a possibility? The novel sort of poses the question, is there a possibility that the deep future could be colonized somehow, or that some remnant of human society lives on so that there's an afterlife for human civilization, for, you know, the human society that we've known? But it does play around with the idea of the afterlife in Egyptian tradition, but in other traditions too, but really in the Egyptian tradition, there's a boat that they take across, a yacht that they take across, a sailing yacht that they take across the Atlantic Ocean called the Solar Bark, which is sort of a play on the boats that the pharaohs used to use to go across the river into the afterlife. And so it plays around with that idea quite a bit.
And so you've mentioned how Nick is, of course, so lonely, and as far as he knows, the only human being left on the planet in the deep future. Talk about how he deals with his isolation by eventually developing what he calls a new religion. But it actually didn't seem all that different from the most ancient religions of humankind, the ones that are still prevalent among many indigenous peoples. Talk about that and what your concept of that religion, in what way does it lead us toward some thinking that we may want to adopt?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of developed a little organically out of the story, but it also, you know, he's aware of the traditions of a lot of hunter-gatherer societies and the sort of early human, as you say, early human religions or systems of spirituality. And he, at a certain point, I think he realizes that his sanity is at risk. And he feels a need, and I think it's kind of a universal human need for meaning that he tries to feel. So he sort of starts patching it together in a little bit of a conscious way. And then it becomes, you know, sort of woven into the fabric of his life. But yeah, so it's kind of responding to a need. But I think in terms of what the religion tells him, and maybe tells us, is one of the things that I sort of, you know, if there were one thing that I'd want readers to take away from this book, is that humanity is not separate from nature. We've, you know, for the whole existence, at least of Western civilization, we've considered ourselves to be separate and superior to or overlooking, you know, nature. And we're really not. We're really a part of it. And so I think that in looking at things in light of the geological history of the earth and all of those billions of years, and that we're really part of that. We belong to that. And the sooner that we realize that we are part of nature, maybe the sooner we will come to take what I consider to be our destiny as a species, which is to become the stewards rather than trying to exploit or destroy nature. We'll become the stewards of life on earth. And I think that would be a great role for us to take. So I think that's the conclusion that he arrives at.
Yes. And yet we do also face the possibility of extinction. Did writing this book, Tim Weed, change any of your thinking about coming to terms with the potential end of the human race?
Well, what it did is, I don't know, after writing the book, I don't know if it's any more or less likely than I thought. It's certainly in the realm of possibility that the human species might go extinct. But this book helped me come to terms with that, because it was, you know, studying geological history and studying the history of life on this planet, and also just studying the life that exists on this planet. I spend a lot of time outdoors and in the forest and in the ocean and things like that. And it would be too bad if the human species goes extinct. Obviously, it would be terrible tragedy. But again, this idea that nature is going to persist, that life on Earth in many different forms will persist and continue to evolve, gives me a sense, in the end, it gives me a sense of hope in the darkness.
Yes, and I thoroughly enjoyed reading this book. It talks about things that are very near and dear to my heart, as I'm sure my regular listeners know. And it was just a terrific read, and it's been great to talk with you about it.
It's been great to talk to you too, Francesca, and thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate your show, and it's great to be part of it.
Tim Weed's The Afterlife Project was named as one of the top sci-fi books by the New Scientist Journal. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests at writersvoice.net. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.